June 1st, 2007 will come to order. Thank you so much for being here on this beautiful sunny day in June. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 984. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
984B, Senate Bill 984B, is a bill that expands the affordable housing credit in two ways. It includes loans used to finance the construction, development, acquisition, or acquisition and rehabilitation of manufactured dwelling park homes, and it also includes loans used to finance the acquisition or acquisition and rehabilitation of housing consisting of a preservation project. A preservation project is a housing project that was previously developed as affordable housing with a contract for rent assistance from the federal government and is being acquired by a sponsoring entity such as a nonprofit or a housing authority. And it applies to tax certifications issued on or after the effective date of the act. By way of background, the 2005 legislature increased the annual limit from $6 million to $11 million.
Thank you. John Van Landingham, Martha McLennan, and Rick Krager. I can tell that summer is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wore this tie so I could remind you that we are from the same community, the Republic of Eugene. My name is John Van Landingham. I work at Lincoln County Legal Aid in Eugene. Thank you for taking us first from yesterday. I'm going to be, I think we're all going to be brief. My job is to testify in favor of Senate Bill 984A and tell you a little bit about it. It amends an existing tax credit created by the legislature in 1989. That tax credit works as follows. For Oregon banks who owe Oregon taxes, if they choose to lend on affordable housing developments and reduce their interest rates by up to 4 percentage points, the bank takes the difference as a tax credit. The bank doesn't make any money off of that. There's no benefit to the bank other than that it is a loan that it can do. But the effective result of that is that loans on affordable housing developments are reduced by 4 percentage points. So instead of borrowing money at 7.5%, we borrow money, and Martha's one of the developers of those projects, we borrow money at 3.5%. As a result of that, two significant things happen. We're obviously able to borrow money cheaper, and we're able to keep rents low. And it makes affordable housing deals feasible or possible that we would not otherwise be able to make. In addition, it leverages private money. The tax credit leverages at a ratio of $25 for every $1 in tax credit. It's an incredibly efficient tool, and it gets banks to invest in these developments that they otherwise would not be able to do. I'm on the board of NOAA. It's a nonprofit bank, 21 Oregon banks. I've listed in my handout what NOAA has done in terms of using this tax credit. Those 21 banks have invested $123 million in affordable housing projects since this tax credit was created. The bill does not have a fiscal impact, doesn't increase the tax credit cap. We started with that in the Senate. We don't have it now. The bill simply allows the credit to be used for two needs that are huge that we did not anticipate previously. One is privately owned subsidized housing projects, which are reaching the end of their life and are going to convert to private rates, private market rates. We'd like to be able to buy some of those. That's what Martha's going to talk about. And the issue that I've been talking about for 2 years, it seems like driving me nuts, mobile home park closures. We'd like to be able to buy some mobile home parks. So in my handout, on the third page of my handout, I've sort of described how the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit fits in to the concept. I was here a week ago talking about HB 2735, the Mobile Home Landlord-Tenant Coalition bill, which you heard last week. So let's assume that a mobile home park is for sale. A typical park around the state is the size of about 50 spaces. There's larger and bigger. and smaller. Typically, they sell for about $50,000 a space. In the metro area, in Central Oregon, they're going to sell for a lot more. One example that I've mentioned here is the park in West Lynn, 55 spaces. The owner believes that he can get, for his 11 acres, he can get $10 million. Okay? That's $180,000 a space. These parks may be purchased either by for-profit developers who are going to close the park and redevelop it as typically higher-end housing, or in our preferred scenario, we can't make this happen, but we hope to encourage it to happen, purchased by a resident cooperative created by the residents of the park, a nonprofit, or a housing authority. This bill is a part of our efforts to encourage the latter to happen, because those entities will maintain the park as a park and as affordable housing. Senate Bill 984 will help us borrow up to 80% of the purchase price of one of those parks if the landlord agrees to sell to us at a lower interest rate that we can afford and make the deal work. House Bill 3551, the document recording fee increase, which most of you have heard about, I hope, generates money for affordable housing. That will help us with the other 20%, the gap financing. So there's the cost of our project. HB 2735, which you heard last week, has in it a capital gains break for landlords who sell voluntarily to these preferred buyers, the nonprofits, the co-ops, the housing authorities. So that's an enticement to the landlord to get them to sell. So far, that was passed last session. It's been used once in those 2 years in a park outside of Corvallis, and it was significant in encouraging that purchase by a resident group. And then finally, HB 2096, which has already passed, creates the new manufactured dwelling nonprofit cooperative, where we hope to create this with residents. Obviously, we're not going to be able to buy every park. That's the point of the rest of HB 2735 that I talked about last week. But 984 is a big part of our effort to try to buy parks and maintain them as parks to prevent them from closing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Martha McLennan. I am the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit affordable housing developer and owner. We've been around for almost 25 years now and have properties in 14 Oregon counties. Our home is in Clackamas County. What I want to talk to you about today is the preservation component of this bill. Preservation properties are properties that were financed by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development or the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Rural Development Program. These were properties that had a financing, in exchange for their financing, had a commitment of affordability for a certain period of time, and that period of time is now running out. What this would do is allow us a tool to help acquire those properties. There are over 10,000 units of these two kinds of programs in the state that are at risk in the next few years. The preservation properties are important properties because they serve a tenant population that's extremely low income. The average income in the properties with this kind of financing that Northwest Housing Alternatives has is under $9,000 per year of family income. Another reason that they're very important is that most of the units have rent assistance attached to them, and that is a contract with HUD, or again, U.S. Department of Rural Development, that is providing a rent subsidy month in, month out, and is valued at over $40 million per year in terms of the amount of rent assistance that's coming into the state with that. Another reason why it's important to look at preserving these properties is that it would be cost-effective. The acquisition and rehab of these properties generally will be significantly less than the development costs of a new project. One of the things that I've provided you is a little handout that illustrates why the OHTC is so valuable. What you can see basically in the bottom line is that without the OHTC, you have a funding gap of $2 million. This is just on a hypothetical 100-unit project. So the OHTC really is very significant in terms of bringing the private dollars to the table, and with that, creating a financing package that works. In affordable housing finance, we're always bringing multiple pieces together. my analogy for that is kind of baking a cake. You need the eggs, the sugar, the butter, and the flour. And without one of those, the recipe doesn't work. And that's also true in affordable housing finance. And the OHTC is a really important piece of that puzzle. So I want to encourage your support of the bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and I'd first like to apologize that I'm not dressed as snappy as my counterpart here, but I'll do my best. We at Oregon Housing Community Services, and Mr. Chairman, I provide you some written testimony. I'm not going to go all the way through that. I'll hit some of the highlights. We at Oregon Housing Community Services are the administrate the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. And just to give you a little bit of history, and I think the staff had mentioned this, the credit was, the cap was increased to $11 million last biennium. To date, since the inception of that program, we've been able to do 263 loans and produce 8,961 units. With the $11 million, we're essentially able to create $275 million of loans. So that's the maximum that we would be able to do. To date, we are around $140 million that we have actually generated. Once we get to the top of that cap, the idea was that the principal paybacks on the loans would create new cap capacity, and we estimated that to be about $31 million a year. And that's essentially what we're able to do right now. So with this particular bill, we're very supportive of Senate Bill 984, and what it does is it expands the use, as my colleagues here have already done very well. I'm not going to repeat everything they have said, but in the area of Manufactured Park, this is going to be a very important tool for us. One of the challenges becomes is providing the primary financing, and to the extent that we can entice banks to come in and actually do that particular funding, this is will be a very effective tool. But again, that's one of our challenges here in the state, we want to try to model what has happened in New Hampshire, and it's been very successful to date. I think they've created refinanced over 90 parks. Is that correct, John? So we're hoping to be able to do the same thing here in the state of Oregon. We do think it's possible with the passage, or this would be a long ways in helping us do that here in the state of Oregon. The other piece, as Martha has already talked about, is the area of preservation. And just to speak specifically to our portfolio, we have in our Section 8 finance portfolio, we have over 4,000 units that will have contracts that expire in the next 7 years. One of the things that isn't mentioned a lot regarding these particular projects is they bring in over $25 million of federal subsidy assistance each year. So that's money that's at risk if we're unable to preserve those and sign those up for another 20 to 30 years. And that's our goal. And again, this particular product will be very helpful in doing that. The one thing I wanted to mention in terms of right now we're doing about $31 million of loans per biennium. With this expanded use, we will see more projects come in. We've done some estimates at the department. We would say between the manufactured parks and the preservation, we would see potentially additional $70 million. Of loans that we would be able to do, projects that demand that. So obviously we will get to the cap quicker than we had anticipated 2 years ago. Now once we get to the cap, then at that point we're dependent on the paybacks of the loans, and again our estimate would be $31 million that we'd be able to do in a biennium once we had reached that cap. So I wanted to just put that out there so that if we want to continue to meet, if we're very successful in the manufactured parks and the preservation, this might be something to revisit in the future in terms of more cap to be able to do these projects. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will wrap up my presentation. If there's any further questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes. Thank you very much for bringing this forward. I like the way this is being put together, and Mr. Krieger, you said that the 200, and I was writing quickly, and it's probably in your notes, but I haven't read it. 275 million is the capacity, and how many are out now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, approximately $140
million. 140, okay, and then 70 million more. If this program came in, you're anticipating something like 70 million more in the next.
In the next 2 years. So if you do our normal $30 million that we have been able to do, and then you add the preservation and manufactured park demand, you could be looking at $100 million for next biennium.
Okay. Two questions. One is, how, what's your sense of how many parks might be, is it a pretty small subset of the parks or might be eligible, might in say a 2 or 5 year window?
Mr.
How many
Chair,
units are we preserving?
Chair, Representative Berger, we're guessing between, in terms of closures, the number of closures in the next 2 years, we're guessing between 6 and 8 parks per year. That's a guess. Through the first 5 months of 2007, 3 parks have closed. Now, that's a much slower rate than the previous 2 years. In 2005, we had 15 parks close, many of them in Washington County. And in 2006, we had 17 parks close, again, many in Washington County. In those 2 years, we lost 1,704 spaces in those 31 closures. So the rate is slower now, only 3 parks so far in the first 5 months of this year. The market has changed. Anecdotally, what we have been told is that in 2006, we had developers making cold calls on park landlords and offering them buckets of money. That's not happening now. It's the same as with the regular real estate market. Things have cooled down. I think it'll come. We think it'll come back. That's why we're seeking all these tools. But we don't think it's going to come back for 2, 3, 4 years. We are actively, I don't mean me individually, but CASA of Oregon is our tool for going out and trying to make a sale happen. CASA is looking for a park to buy now and has been for about 6 months. We need to find a park where the residents want to do it, where the landlord wants to sell and sell to us. In some cases, landlords don't like being feeling that they're being coerced into this, and that it makes financial sense. And so far, we haven't lost any, but we haven't found any that want to sell to us. So we're guessing 1 to 3. In some ways, it's a trial for us to see whether this tool and the other tools that we've talked about here will help us preserve parks. And if they work, then we'll try to tweak them and make them better in the next session. We don't think that what we're doing this session solves the problem.
Can I continue? I'm glad to hear this discussion because I think this is one where you're trying to work for win-win. Everybody wants, we don't want coercion here, but we want tools that people can come to the table and say, well, I'll bring this and you bring that and we'll come together. One more question about preservation projects in Section 8. You talked about 4,000 units within 7 years. What kind of shape are these units in? I worry a little bit about, wouldn't it be better at some level to build new, or is there any hope for building new, or do you understand what I'm right. saying? At some level, at some point, how much are you going to put in a facility that isn't worth right. the money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, very good question, and I'll speak specifically to the 4,000 units that I had talked about in my testimony. And those are specifically our projects that we do the inspections. I can say they are older projects, but for the most part, I would say 80% of them are in very good shape. Now, obviously, as we put new financing onto this, there is going to be a whole rehabilitation that we do on the project. I would say that, and Martha can correct me here, but it's still going to be far more cheaper to be able to rehab this project than it would be to do a brand new construction. I hear what you're saying, though. Certainly, you don't want to throw money into a project that's going to, you know, cost a fortune to be able to rehab it. So we would certainly do prudent underwriting, look at this, look at the project itself to determine if it was one that we could indeed preserve. But I do want to say, in terms of our portfolio, I think we have a very good portfolio. We have a whole unit that goes out and does the inspections. We have good owners that maintain these very well. I'm not saying all that way, but certainly for the most part they are. And I can, and Martha can maybe speak to some of the other projects.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart and the members of the committee. The in the model that I provided, that is estimating about $15,000 per unit rehab. As a nonprofit, one of our goals is to put our financing packages together with the anticipation that we might need to refinance or do rehab again in about a 15-year cycle. The typical open market would look to doing that in a 5 to 7 year cycle. So we do try to make a more significant capital investment at the front end of it to ensure that the property is going to be in good shape for the long term.
Thank you. Thank you for your work on this, too.
Thank you very much. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rick, the combination of reduced interest and the tax credits in this process to participate, do we know how much we're getting into each unit on a monthly basis that we're actually subsidizing the home occupants, the low-income home occupants, so that we know the total amount of state dollars, and then in addition, I recognize there's Section 8 money coming from feds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, with the rental units that we build with the tax credit, the money must be passed through dollar for dollar in a rent reduction. So in my testimony, the written testimony, the second page of that shows how the rents are reduced dollar for dollar. We're not doing the same thing, not proposing to do the same thing with the prepay projects, the preservation projects, because they're already at a lower rate, or with the mobile home parks, because they're also at a lower rate, and it doesn't quite work that way. But with the current use of the tax credit, we can say that. Now, I think you asked a broader question, whether there's other subsidy in the projects. And in many cases, there are. I don't know that we have a dollar figure. It probably, I think Martha's example was a cake. You know, there's lots of different kinds of cakes. And I think with most of our projects, she only described four ingredients of that cake. Most of the projects have 10 to 12 ingredients. And there are different sorts of things, a bunch of private money, but also different subsidies as well.
But I'm going to guess, Mr. Chair, that somebody keeps track of all of the various different ingredients, including the federal money in this, so that we know exactly, on an average, how much we're getting in on a monthly basis in public money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I do have all the ingredients to the cake. I don't have that at my fingertips, but I would be certainly happy to provide you some of the specifics of all the different dollars that go into.
Okay, I had one follow-up question.
We hire gray-suited guys with conservative ties.
I had one follow-up question, and it really goes back to what Mr. Van Lanningham has been doing successfully and then it also touches on what Martha has discussed relative to the preservation. That is, as we have passed bills to allow us to go in and help park owners buy the parks back, has there been any attempt to try and figure out if in the preservation of these USDA and the other apartment complexes, what has been the idea of condominiumizing those with the tenants in place?
Not a whole lot, but it is possible. We're right now looking at a portfolio of six properties, 214 units in four jurisdictions. One of those properties does have the potential for home ownership, and we are talking in partnership with the Portland Community Land Trust about the possibility of having some or all of the units within that property be converted to home ownership. So there is some potential there. Again, with the average income of the tenants being so very, very low in these properties, their buying power, their ability to get a mortgage is going to be pretty compressed. But there may be some opportunities to do that.
If I can add, not necessarily with regard to the use of this tax credit, but Eugene has had that concept for 20 years, largely because of the suggestion of a private developer who's been active in our efforts there, a guy named Rob Bennett. And he, as a result of his suggestions, we've built a lot of our affordable housing projects are townhouses, which are easily converted to condos. And in fact, they were legally laid out so that we at some point could condoize them if the market gets right and if we can make them work financially. So it's a great idea.
Others? In the original bill, Senate Bill 984 without a letter, there was a proposal that would have increased the cap, as you refer to it, from $11 million to $13 million in beginning, and then $15 million after July 1, 2008. What would the effect of that kind of a change be on your funds available and your capacity to do things, if any, in this biennium, in the coming biennium?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. What it would do, you heard me talk a little bit about at some point, if our estimates are true, we will get to a point where we bumped up against the cap and we have to be conservative in terms of our allocation. Maybe we're doing $30 million. With the increase in the cap, as we proposed, we felt like we would be able to go out there longer. And obviously, with a $15 million, you're going to be able, from a principal payback, be able to do more than the $30 million on a biennial basis. So the cap increase gave us more time. And certainly with these projects, there is, and Martha could probably speak better than I to this, but when you're doing the planning, you want to know that the resources are going to be there, and because there's a lot of pre-planning associated with these types of projects. So to the extent that it provides assurance to the folks out in the field that the money is going to be there, I think that would help us in terms of the pre-planning affordable housing.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony and the clear explanations of the projects. If I may just simply say that I appreciate the work that you all do. I have seen some interesting projects in the Eugene area. I remember one specifically involving veterans that involved at least 10 ingredients, and I was astounded at the creativity that you use in order to help people who need it find housing. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. Are there others who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 984? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 984. And we'll open. Where's my. I constantly put my agenda in the last bill folder. We'll open a. Representative Greenlick, you're here on 3558, aren't you? And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3558. Yes, I see that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3558 is the new Healthy Kids bill. I've included in your packet several things. I'll go through them quickly. First, I put the SMS for House Bill 2201A. This is what you have what you had in front of you at the time when we examined this bill. I included this MS to remind you of the issues that were discussed and the amendments that you've worked the bill with in order to make it a engrossed version before it went to Ways and Means. The revenue impact statement also for that bill is also included, and it is included in order to be able to give you a comparison in a way with what the revenues expected under this version of this bill. The main differences you would find in this bill that are few from House Bill 2201. But the way of the distribution of the different revenue amounts are also in your packet. These are charts that show what current cigarette tax revenue distributions are today. And then the second one would be what Healthy Kids 2201-A as it left the House revenue first time what it was, and then how it became as a dash B amendment in the Ways and Means in the Committee Ways and Means, and finally the last page is what the distribution under the new bill, the new scheme of distribution would be, and those are different from each stage of those. The main differences, I try to document them for you on the page that says the draft, and it has a revenue impact schedule. And under the schedule of numbers. The differences are basically a voter referral. The 3558 sends to the bill itself to the voters, although with still a three-fifths majority vote, and sends it into the November election. And it requires, of course, a bill that does that, and the bill that would be enabling for that vote referral would be House Bill 3559. The implementation date, of course, changes with this from signing die, or when it was applicable to make the implementation date to January 1st, 2008, if approved. And the floor tax or the inventory tax follows that date as well. The change in the distribution order that basically happens from the time when you were working the bill is the change in the distribution first for the tobacco use reduction account goes to 4.918 in 2007 and 10% in 2009-11 biennium, that is. And then, of course, that changes the way things are done, and then the Healthy Kids program becomes a big container, if you will, and it takes a different distribution from that container to the safety net at the level of 3.97%, and that's not in the bill or not in the tax distribution section itself, but you would find it in the beginning of the bill in page 2 where the definition of the Healthy Kids program is.
In section 2, yes.
Right. That also 1.52 distribution to the rural health care also occurs in there. The second difference, or one of the second technical difference in this, is the way the task force, tobacco task force, is funded through this bill. The tobacco task force in 2201 was funded only until January of 2008, providing that Senate Bill 181 would have passed and funded the task force from the top of the tobacco revenue rather than the general fund. This one allows for continuous appropriation from the top of the tobacco taxes for the whole biennium, going from July 07 to June 2009. This you would find in Section 22. And finally, I have to mention, if today the House have, or the floor of the House have passed Senate Bill 571, we would have to include a reconciled, if you will, revenue impact, because this time around, it doesn't happen all the time, but the legislature is, at least from the revenue type of way of looking at this, is actually adopting conflicting policies when it comes to this revenue raising. So one bill raises the revenue and the other one gives it away.
And that bill does what?
And that bill does the
571
Clean Indoor Act.
Oh, right. So your estimate, the result is that your estimate is that we'll sell fewer cigarettes.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. And in that, we would be looking, if that occurs, about $75 million with this bill to be reconciled. Also, when you look at the fiscal impact for this bill, different from House Bill 2201, this bill will not have the impact of the program of the Healthy Kids itself. If you look at the fiscal impact statement, this bill would have only the costs of the elections, because the fiscal impact of the program itself would happen as a result of the bill that provides for the election. That's House Bill 3559. So that will be different.
Well, that, if I may, that bill pays for the election and then appropriates the funds if the measure passes.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And then finally, there are certain assumptions, of course, and risks that we do with every bill. One of the risks that might be here is what happens, and that's always been the discussion, is what happens if there is more and more success in, let's say, for example, the if we're investing $40-some million in tobacco reduction account, would that reduce our amounts and make it unsustainable? It needs to be declared that under our assumptions here is that the investment in the tobacco reduction account does not reduce smoking any further than we have. So just...
I think we ought to give it to ourselves as a pay raise if we can't do any better than that.
Well, Mr. Chair...
Representative Butler, yes.
And Representative Butler, the studies and the looks that we've seen suggest that there might be an impact. However, in order to be able to quantify impacts of that sort, we need a stronger suggestion from ability to actually affect and reduce habits just by education. We think price and laws have a lot stronger both carrot and stick than only advertisement.
Mr. Chair, I guess the concern I've got is real about the Tura, and that is that if the Tura gives us absolutely no indication, I mean, you as a committee chair here would not spend the millions of dollars, clear up to $11.4 million per biennium, without some kind of an ascertainable standard, and then without some expectation that there was some return. At that particular point, it seems like to me that that's $11.4 million that could be spent on healthy kids programs if the net return is actually zero. And if we would spend it on healthy kids and then continue to increase, as the economist has said, increase the tax and if tax and laws availability are greater deterrents than advertising the ill effects of the use of tobacco, then perhaps that's what the better place to use the money would be to deter it.
Excuse me for pontificating.
Thank you, Representative Butler. We have three members with us who would like to be heard on this bill, and I'd like to get to them. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44 from North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for having us today and returning to the discussion of the Healthy Kids Plan. It's good to be before you today. You have House Bill 3558 in front of you. The three of us have been engaged in efforts to make sure before the end of session we have another conversation about how we are going to deal with the fact that 117,000 children in the state are uninsured. So the three of us have gotten together. What you have before us today is a bill very similar to 2201B. It is a simplified version of that bill. As you'll notice, we've rearranged it. We've tried to make it more readable because this is a statutory referral. We've added some very effective, I think, whereas clauses, which really lay out the issue. We have too many uninsured children. We know that uninsured children are less likely to get care and be set with health problems. We also know that a robust tobacco prevention education program is essential for reducing tobacco use. And I'd like to point out line 18 and 19 on page 1. Whereas it is in the best interest of the state to provide for the health and welfare of Oregon's children. The differences from 2201B, which have been mentioned, is previously the subsidy that we would be that we were going to provide was up to 300% of the federal poverty line. This bill reduces that to 250% of federal poverty. The other change is that listening to the discussion around the need for more prevention, we have added into the bill coverage for health insurance coverage for pregnant women up to 250% of the federal poverty line, knowing that if women have comprehensive health care while pregnant, their birth outcomes are more favorable, hence the future health of the children involved. I think it's important to understand that we have listened to some of the concerns that were raised. It's so hard for me to be not a little bit concerned about dropping the income level for the subsidy. At 250% of poverty, families will still have a difficult time purchasing the private health option that would be available through this plan, but it is still available. And I would hope at some future date we would reconsider that. But at this time, I believe this program is sustainable. I think we are going to hear from the other representatives about the revenue side of this. But this is the program we need to do to move forward with health care reform in the state. It's not the only piece, but it's the piece we can do today. It is a solution that is achievable and sustainable. And I believe this vehicle, as a statutory referral, is very viable. Now, I also want to point out that House Bill 2967, which came out of the Joint Ways and Means Committee this morning, is identical to this bill. Also a statutory referral, same bill. So we have prepared the Dash 1 amendments, which I know we're not in work session, but I just wanted to make sure you know that they are there. The Dash 1 amendments were drafted to convert House Bill 3558 back to a piece of legislation that we would vote on in this building, hopefully before the end of session, to reconsider the fact that we have an opportunity here to provide health insurance for children in the state who so desperately need it. And I would just like to end by saying I was originally a skeptic when we started talking about the tobacco tax as the revenue source. But unfortunately, it is a very stable and robust revenue source. And though we will decrease smoking in terms of prevention education programs that we would fund with this, and raising the cost would help keep younger folks from starting to smoke, it is still an addiction. People will continue to smoke, and we will be able to deal with a very important health issue using that revenue source. And I would urge you to support this bill and give it another shot.
Thank you very much. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Gelser. I'm from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. And I would have to say this is a very fine-looking committee. Perhaps the best committee still meeting in the building.
Because I have another chair of the committee. We have to object to that.
Thank you for hearing us today on this bill. I wanted to build a little bit on what Representative Kotek has already talked about. And before I move on to talk about the tax, the tobacco tax, I also wanted to address the issue of reducing that poverty level from 300% to 250% of the federal poverty level. There was concern that was raised in the previous discussion about what is the appropriate level to subsidize health care costs. And I think there are two things even about this bill that are very important to understand and be very clear about. Even at 250% of the federal poverty level, we would not be providing free health care to these children. We would be providing subsidized health care. The families would still need to be paying a premium to buy this coverage for their children and would still be participating in whatever cost sharing was there. Although we are dropping it to 250% of the federal poverty level, just like in House Bill 2201B, there is a universality to this in that we are creating a private health insurance product that any of us would be eligible to buy into at full cost. So those who are at 251% of the federal poverty level, who continue to have children, who don't have access to health insurance, for the first time will have access to a comprehensive health plan benefit that is closer in reach to them. And this is a way that even though we would not be providing subsidies to that care, it will bring care into closer reach for many of these children who continue to go without health care. On the issue of the tobacco tax, we've had extensive conversations here about the Washington and Oregon smoke dance and the elasticity of the tobacco tax. I wanted to address the issue of what does a tobacco tax have to do with health care for children? That's a question that I've been asked often, and it's something that I feel rather strongly about. So just to put into the record, children are twice as likely as non-smoking adults to be exposed to secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke contains more than 250 chemicals known to be toxic or carcinogenic. Children who are exposed to secondhand smoke are inhaling many of the same cancer-causing substances and poisons as smokers. 60% of U.S. children aged 3 to 12 are exposed to these poisons. Among these 60% of children, they are impacted more severely than adults when exposed to secondhand smoke. This is because their small bodies are still developing physically. They have higher respiration rates than adults, so they're actually taking more breaths of that air than we are. Children run the greatest relative risk of experiencing damaging and lifelong health effects, and it is demonstrated in the facts that are available through research. Babies exposed to secondhand smoke are likely to have a low birth weight, have weaker lungs, and a higher risk of acute lower respiratory infections, including bronchitis and pneumonia. These children are far more likely to die of SIDS than children not exposed to secondhand smoke. At least 150,000 cases of pneumonia and bronchitis in children under the age of 18 months. So that's less than a year and a half. Pneumonia in a baby under the age of 18 months are attributed to exposure to secondhand smoke. Thousands and thousands of these will result in hospitalizations that would not have been necessary had they not been exposed to secondhand smoke. Children exposed to secondhand smoke have reduced oxygen flow to tissues, comparable to children with anemia, cyanotic heart disease, or chronic lung disease. These children don't have that yet, but they're being exposed to secondhand smoke. We know that secondhand smoke is responsible among children for 13% of ear infections, 26% of ear tube insertions, 24% of tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies, 13% of asthma cases, 16% of physician visits for cough, and 20% of all lung infections in children under the age of 5 are attributed to the effects of secondhand smoke. Each year, around 150 childhood deaths are attributed to lower respiratory infection potentially caused by secondhand smoke. And about 148 children, incidentally, die each year from fires that are started by tobacco products. In addition to all of these things, the secondhand smoke, about 20 Oregon children every day begin smoking. Oregon is the only state in the nation that has actually reduced its tobacco tax within the last 10 years. Recently, even the state of Texas increased its tobacco tax, I believe, by about $1. Some have argued that the tobacco tax will cause people to quit smoking, and therefore we're saying smoke more so we can pay for kids' health care. In fact, that's not the case. That's not what's demonstrated or the information that's come to us. We know that, unfortunately, we cannot make everybody stop smoking. If we could, I think that that would be a fantastic thing. This program with this tax is sustainable, even though we will sell 28 million fewer packs of cigarettes each year as a result of the tax, which means that in addition to the TURA, the tax itself, for those that can be influenced to quit smoking, who are primarily younger people who have not yet become lifelong addicts, it's a very effective tobacco prevention and tobacco reduction project by raising that tobacco tax. This bill, it's essential that we get this into place, whether it's through a straight up and down vote in the building or through a statutory referral. It certainly would be my preference to just get it done and be able to tell the kids of the state, we got it done, it's taken care of, we're going to take care of you. This is a fiscally responsible plan. I think the new layout of the bill is more clear about what is included in this plan. I think that that wasn't as clear in our discussions before. I think that there was some confusion about other aspects of the governor's budget. It's very clear if you read through this bill what it is that's included. We have 117,000 children who are waiting for access to health care. Unfortunately, this revised bill isn't going to take care of all of them through a subsidized program, but all of them will have access to purchase a plan. And for those kids, the vast majority of that 117,000 are below that 250% of the federal poverty level. This is sustainable. It's responsible. People will quit smoking. Unfortunately, not enough of them. The tax will pay for it. And the facts around the impact of tobacco use on children more than justifies the use of this tax to fund these very critical services that I think we can all agree are very important for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenleaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenleaf, House District 33, Northwest Portland, out west of the farm country. And I appreciate you hearing this bill. This bill brings to mind the story of the hunters that are up in the outback in Alaska, and at the end of a week of hunting, the float plane comes in, lands on the lake, and comes up to them and says, okay, let's go. Where's the caribou? We'll get it back. Well, we have three caribou. The bush pilot says, three caribou? I told you you can only shoot one caribou. Why did you shoot three and ask me to take it back? So, well, last time when we were up here, we shot two caribou, and you had that same problem. We offered you $1,000, and you agreed to take the two caribou. So we're prepared to offer you $3,000 if you'll take the three caribou back. So, well, the bush pilot, being what a bush pilot is, said, oh, all right, well, let's try it. And he strapped the caribou on the platoons and stuffed it wherever he could stuff it and put all his stuff in and got him in the plane, and the plane went down to the end of the lake and revved up his engine as much as it could and just zoom along the lake, got about 50 feet over the lake and got over the beach and crashed into some trees. And one hunter woke up, the other one woke up and one said to the other, where are we? And the guy looked around and said, well, I think we're about 50 yards short of where we crashed last time.
That's great.
Now, we're here in this mad search for rationality in this building, and we did learn from the fact that 2201 crashed and burned. Nobody was killed in the crash, but it really set us trying to find a way to get health care to the kids of Oregon. And that's something we start with, the assumption that every one of the 60 of us in the legislature, 60 plus the governor, I guess, 60 of us in the House really, really want to see happen. We believe the 30 in the Senate want to really see it happen as well. And the question is, what we're doing is groping for a formula that will allow us to come together on this and to pass this bill. We probably will pass something on health care reform, probably something like Senate Bill 329 we've been working on over in the Senate through this whole session. That'll give us a roadmap to begin to work on moving toward universal access. And we all recognize there's a huge problem. In fact, Governor Kitzhaber, when talking about this bill, said, well, we know the healthcare system is like a big liner that's sinking, and it's going to sink, but we have kids out there in the water, and what we need to do is to find, in the meantime, a raft out there to get under the kids that are in the water while we try and figure out how to save this sinking ship, which is the Oregon healthcare system that has more than 600,000 people uninsured statewide. We think this fits in that. We think we want to have as many different arrows in the quiver of trying to find a way to get health care to the kids. This bill, as amended, with the amendments Representative Kotek talked about, will give us a chance to have, perhaps if it works out that way and looks like it makes sense, a straight up and down vote. I don't think anybody in this House thinks we should do our business by sending it to the people all the time, but sometimes that is the only alternative. So what we hope here is we've stripped the bill down some, we've clarified it. Representative Kotek did a lot of work in the reorganization, and we owe her a debt of gratitude on that. And we hope that you'll see this as a way to help this search for a way to deal with the uninsured health care of the kids of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate all the work that all three of you have put in on this bill and others as well. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Yes. It may be in here, and I haven't had time to read it. But you mentioned that the cap level is 250%. Okay. In here, or is it by rule that the subsidies, where do they start and where do they end? Is it in here? In other words, how much of a subsidy at 100%, how much at 150, or is that in there?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, excellent question. Page 3, Section 4, where it talks about the private health option that would be administered by the Office of Private Health Partnerships. Subsection 3 there talks about, that's where it talks about between 200% and 250% of poverty would be the subsidy. That the levels of subsidies between 200 and 250 would be determined in rule. We did have this discussion in Ways and Means. The fiscal being assumed is... that has not changed in terms of the fiscal's assumptions around the subsidies, and I can get that to you, but that would be determined in rule.
Thank you.
Well, just to clarify, the rule would have to make certain that the appropriation was enough to cover, so that would be a limitation on the rule, would it not?
Mr. Chair, my assumption is what would be passed with the bill, with the fiscal estimate, which is very similar to what we dealt with in Ways and Means, had some assumptions around that subsidy level. Obviously, it would depend on what's allocated by the legislature, and that would drive the rule process. Yeah.
Thank you. That's exactly.
There are two variables, though. One variable is how many people would you provide the subsidy to, and the other is the amount of the subsidy. The appropriation would limit the joint factors of the expectation and the amount.
Right, and the point I was trying to elicit was that this is not some unfettered rulemaking capability. It's very much limited by those two factors. Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Berger.
Yes, I have another question, and I'm not sure to address it to. It may be to you, Mr. Chair. It's sort of a clarification of how many caribou and how many airplanes we've got out there. that was, Representative, a great story. We were all, I couldn't remember it all, but we were rapt wondering where you were going with those caribou and that airplane. So we have a bill 2967, which looks exactly like this, that just came out of Ways and Means. And to the floor. To the floor. And then we have a dash one amendment to this that looks like what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, what I asked Legislative Council to do was to assume the timelines that we had in 2201B. So what it does, it strips out the statutory referral language and returns the implementation dates to what was in 2201B, which would mean the start of the tobacco tax, I believe, October 1, implementation of the program January 1, 2008.
So, excuse me, Mr. Chair, can I pursue this? So, the contemplated 2201's implementation type would go into this bill. Is that, I mean, it would be implemented voted on instead of referred.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that would be the intent, to have another vehicle for an in-the-house vote.
Okay, then there's a companion bill to this, and what does it do? There was mention of another bill from Mazin, 3559. What is that bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, if you decide to move 3558 as it is in statutory referral form, it needs a companion bill, 3559, which is essentially the election portion, which would have a fiscal to it that Mazin referred to, the fiscal of whatever it is to put that in the voter pamphlet and whatnot. And then if that passes along with it, if it is successful at the ballot, then the money is allocated based on.
Okay, I'm only missing one caribou here, Mr. Chair, and that would be the companion bill to 2967. Is there such a bill? If it is identical to this, it is a statutory referral. Am I right? Or no, it isn't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, it should also have I don't know if it's using the same one or has a different one. I don't know the answer to that question, but my impression was the goal for any companionability, either statutory referrals, would be a November 2007 election date.
Okay. I think I've found all my caribou, and we're still looking for pilots.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Berger. Part of your answer, I think, is part of the answer to the implied question, I think, is that, as with a good joke, a great deal of the impact is in the timing.
Exactly.
And the other comment I would make is that we still have a large number of bill numbers that we haven't used yet.
Yes, I understand that, Mr. Chair. Just like there's a lot of caribou out there, you know, I understand. I'm just trying to get sort of my arms around the ones that know. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Butler.
I have a couple of questions, Mr. Chair, and one of them deals with availability at present. The second one deals with insurance in Oregon. But have we identified the reasons and the solutions for the reported number of children that are presently qualified for the Oregon Health Plan that don't avail themselves of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it's an excellent question. Of the 117,000 uninsured children, approximately two-thirds of them would be currently eligible for the Oregon Health Plan as we sit today. Unfortunately, the legislature, and because of budget situations in the state, has really not allocated the dollars to cover those folks. Other issues have also been involved. We have not had a robust outreach and retention program in the state to outreach to those kids and keep them on the program. We've had administrative barriers, length of the application, the fact that we ask children, their parents can re-enroll their kids every 6 months. What we will have with Healthy Kids is outreach, retention, 12-month enrollment, simplified application form. Not only are we going to ask the legislature to fund the actual slots for those children, we're going to implement the procedures and the processes to get them on the program.
Follow-up question.
Please, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns that I have is certainly we recognize that I think sections 1 through 5 will require federal approval to do what we need to do. I think we have to ask and receive, according to Section 8, that DHS has to go back to Centers for Medical and Medicaid Services for the necessary waivers to implement these. But then we also have to find insurance carriers that are willing to do all of the things that are required here. I'm always hesitant when I see the state of Oregon not allow insurance carriers, excuse me, to do certain things on their own, and then when we feel like it's a good idea that we'd like to extend some coverage to some other groups of folks, that we change the rules and then say insurance carriers come forward and provide this coverage. Do we know that the Office of Private Health Partnerships will be able to find the companies that will be willing to do this, and if they do, why haven't they been willing to do it in the past, or are we just removing some of those barriers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, again, excellent questions. I would just point out that we actually have CMS approval to move our income eligibility on the Oregon Health Plan and fee up to 200% of poverty. That was passed in, I believe, the 05 session. We just have not implemented that. So that we're already part of the way there in some of this. What's beneficial about this program is it builds on the existing programs we have, the Oregon Health Plan and FEOP, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Most of the children would be qualified, would go into the Oregon Health Plan or Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Above 200%, between 200 and 250%, that is the sliding scale, the subsidy. Above 250, people could buy the private health option. The Office of Private Health Partnership will be able to put out an RFP to solicit carriers or carrier to provide that private health option. The plan does ask that have a comprehensive health benefit package similar to the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit plan. We believe by pooling that population of children that we can find carrier or carriers to provide that private health option at an affordable rate with reasonable co-pays that we will be able to serve those children and families.
And follow-up final, if I may, would that be a consortium of insurance companies where insurance companies would go together and work together as a block, or do we anticipate somehow that we'll have to quasi-form an insurance company who would be willing to take these risks for this population?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I believe the office is here. They might be able to answer that better, but the thing is that we want to provide a private health option that allows access into the private market. The carriers are there. They have expressed interest. It would really come down to who wants to play in the game and respond to the request for proposal.
There are private carriers that are actively involved in the FEOP program right now. And there's no indication that there wouldn't be adequacy to deal with this. There is, in fact, a children and family piece already in FIOP that doesn't have a lot of members in it yet, but we think that will not be a problem. We've had no testimony that it will be a problem. We heard these in the Health Committee and worked on these bills using 2201 as the vehicle, and insuring kids is really not a hard thing to do because you're not worrying about the huge catastrophic potential in covering kids.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I just wanted to build on that. I think that when Governor Kitzhaber talked about throwing those life rafts out under the children, really insuring kids are a population that are less expensive than other populations to cover. There's less risk that comes with them. And by pooling all of them together, we really create a stable pool of insured lives. So this is a place not so much of the government stepping in and making it happen, but really facilitating to create the conditions that make it possible to provide affordable health insurance to children that currently don't have access to it.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? I know we have a number of other witnesses that I'd like to get to this afternoon. Thank you very much for your testimony, very thorough review of this bill. Before I call it the next panel, I'd like to note that we will not get to the work session on 3057 today. And if we do not get to the public hearing on 2001, and I don't expect us to, that will be carried over until Monday. May we have Carrie Frederick, Destiny, and Sebastian. And as they're coming up, I would note that there are several other witnesses, and if all witnesses can keep their remarks short, we can get everyone in today. Thank you. Thank you very much for waiting. Your children have been very patient this afternoon.
Thank you. Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity for me to tell you about my family. Destiny is 9 and Sebastian is 6. Oh, she's not quite 9. She'll be 9 in a couple weeks. We live in Eagle Creek, just outside of Portland. We are here in support of Healthy Kids Plan. Right now, Destiny and Sebastian have coverage through Oregon Health Plan, but I constantly worry that they might lose it. They both have special health needs. Destiny has cerebral palsy, asthma, and another health condition that requires annual monitoring. She just had surgery in April. Sebastian's 6. He has an immune deficiency, asthma, reflux, a skin problem, teeth, kidney, liver. Kind of goes on, and he gets sick a lot easier and requires a lot of hospitalizations. He was in the hospital over Easter. We got out on Easter Day. They both spend several hundred dollars worth of medicines a month. And right now, my husband works full time. I work part time. I'm also a full time student. Our income always falls between getting services and losing services and getting ahead, really. Last spring, I quit working to go back to school so that I can take care of our family. I'll go into that further in a minute. When I quit working to go back to school, we lost our private health insurance, and the kids were without health insurance for several months. It was hard. I didn't know what to do. What happens if Sebastian gets sick and has to go in the hospital? Destiny's monitoring could wait, but if he needed to go in the hospital, he needed to go. I went ahead and applied for Oregon Health Plan. We qualified. They've had it for almost a year now. But my husband just got a raise. And they might lose their insurance again. My husband has cancer for the third time and has been without medical insurance also during that last year. We're already facing huge health care challenges. I don't know what we're going to do if they lose their health insurance. Healthy Kids Now would ensure that my children continue to receive the medical coverage they need to stay out of the hospital. Prevention is much cheaper than a long hospital stay. An affordable plan that helps working families like ours would be a tremendous peace of mind to me. My husband's raise should be a help to our family, but instead, under current Oregon Health Plan requirements, it may end up costing the children's health, or we've already filed bankruptcy once because of medical bills. So,
it's just not right. There's other families like ours. I work for a nonprofit, and that nonprofit has children with severe disabilities, and most of those families are in the same position we're in. There's also a stigma often around low-income parents, and I just want to tell you that that stigma a lot of times means that says that parents who don't have much money, they aren't well educated, they maybe neglect their children, and it's not true. Low income does not equal bad parenting. Sometimes when you're a good parent, you have to choose between medicine and milk, and it's you try to do everything for your kids, but it's really not a choice that anybody should have to make. Oregon Children Families need you to prioritize the health of our kids. I urge you to pass the Healthy Kids Plan for Destiny and Sebastian and all the other 117,000 kids out there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Mrs. Frederick? Thank you very much. And thank you, Sebastian and Destiny, for coming with your mom today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cindy Becker, Katie Gaither, and Rick Bennett. Please, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's obvious that none of us have a life since we're here on this gorgeous, gorgeous afternoon. But I'm here. My name is Cindy Becker, and I am the Executive Director of Coalition for Healthy Oregon. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the Coalition in support of House Bill 3558. I'm not going to go into any extensive testimony except to point out a few things. First of all, what the biggest priority for the Coalition is really healthy families. This is a part of it, but we also mourn the decline in the standard population, and we certainly hope that either through this vehicle or another vehicle on the Senate side that there is an opportunity to restore some of the folks who have lost their health care coverage on standard, because we know that parents who have health coverage are more likely to enroll their children in health coverage and to also to get the preventative health care that they need. The other piece that I want to mention is the area about outreach, and it really responds to what Representative Butler was saying. There are currently 60,000 children who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. The Medicaid managed care plans that make up the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, about 235,000 lives that are served through the Medicaid managed care plan, 60% of them are children. These plans know who these other children are. They know where they live. They have the capacity to serve them today. They actually have the capacity to serve everyone up to the 250% level as well. The issue isn't just adopting legislation and saying we now have a healthy kids program. The work is going to be working with these families and getting these kids enrolled. They're eligible now. They should be enrolled now. But for a variety of reasons, they're not. That is really going to be the real work and the real success of the Healthy Kids programs, is working with these families, reducing the obstacles, and making sure that these children are enrolled. And the Medicaid managed care plans stand ready to do that now. They're capable of doing it. They have the capacity, and we want to join in this effort. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great. I'm Katie Gaither. I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Oregonians for Health Security, and we, too, want to express our excitement and encouragement that this plan is moving forward again. We've testified in support of all the Healthy Kids Plan bills, but we're very excited that this one is moving forward. I want to share with you some stories. Every day I write the Daily Dose and deliver it to your boxes of profiling a different family, such as Carrie's, who was profiled today, expressing their concerns over healthcare and sharing their stories. So I have a couple short stories, not to keep you here very long, of families that couldn't be here today but that would benefit very much from the Healthy Kids Plan. Kim, who is a nurse in Portland, works at a temporary job, so she doesn't have health insurance. Her daughter is uninsured and has severe mental health needs. She spent 8.5 hours in the emergency room trying to get help for her daughter and now has huge hospital bills and can't get the services her daughter needs. With a Healthy Kids plan, she would be able to have affordable, comprehensive, preventative coverage for her daughter. Noah is a 5-year-old in Marion County. His dad has insurance through his employer, and Noah is uninsured. He was on the Oregon Health Plan until his dad got a job, but the family can't afford the coverage through the father's employer, so the 5-year-old is uninsured. And his mom worries about normal childhood things, an ear infection, falling from a tree, things like that. And the last story is Julie from Baker City, who's a healthcare provider, and her 17-year-old son is uninsured. He's a wrestler who got injured at school wrestling, and they then had the ER bill for $189. And we're glad that that's all it was, but would be very thankful to have some help providing insurance for their family. And just on a personal note, as a young mother with young children, you never know when it's an ear infection versus teething, and the peace of mind you could give parents would do so much for kids in the state and for parents in the state. So we really encourage you to pass this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I think I'm testifying on the House Bill 3558, but perhaps Representative Berger will be able to clarify that for me later. The material I provided to you should look familiar. It's the material that we distributed about a month and a half or so ago related to House Bill 2201. We are still supportive of the Healthy Kids program. We're still supportive of funding that through an increase in the tobacco tax. Provided you the survey results that we completed earlier this year with members of with our members here in Oregon, and I would prefer, I think we would, AARP would prefer that you actually take action yourselves during the session to establish this program and the funding. But if necessary, goes to the people for approval as a statutory member measure, we would be supportive of that as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Andy Miller, Laura Etherton. Etherton.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Andy Miller. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for the Oregon Business Association. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. OBA supports access to basic health care for all Oregonians. We will consider all serious proposals based on sound business principles. The Healthy Kids Program is a good first step towards comprehensive health care reform. We have two concerns surrounding the Healthy Kids Initiative. The first is, we as a state are about to make a significant investment in K-12 education. Children without health care are less likely to be successful academically. We owe it to our state's children and to the taxpayers to send them to school healthy and make good use of that investment in K-12 education. Healthy kids and a related increase in tobacco tax is popular with the voters. Our concern is with the legislators. We strongly encourage you to show critical political courage and practical wisdom and enact Healthy Kids before you leave the building. If that fails, we, of course, will support a referral. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. We're a public interest organization that's been here in Oregon for about 35 years now. I wanted to thank you for hearing this important bill and offer our support for 3558. Oregonians across the state are facing rising health care costs, from premiums to out-of-pocket costs, and we support all the different efforts working to reduce those costs and increase quality and accountability, and the Healthy Kids Plan fits right in. It is critical to address this issue in this term, and we applaud folks who are really pursuing every possible route to either enact this session or to give the voters the opportunity to make this a reality. I don't think anyone in this building thinks it's acceptable for 117,000 Oregon children to lack health insurance. And this plan makes sense as a solution to that problem. It makes sense to give children guaranteed access to preventative care, to treatment for chronic conditions, for regular checkups. And it makes sense to fund that in part through a tobacco tax for several reasons. Doing so will partially offset the increased health care costs caused by tobacco. And it will fund not only this important program, but also tobacco prevention programs that are proven to reduce smoking. The increased cost of tobacco, as you've also become aware of, will actually help to discourage children from taking up smoking. Research has estimated that by increasing the tobacco tax as proposed here, will save the lives of over 9,000 children alive today. They will not start smoking, and they will not die from smoking-caused illness. In addition to the health benefits of increasing the tobacco tax and funding prevention programs, it also just makes sense in terms of dollars and cents. Cutting health care costs significantly, not only in the long term, and those are the most significant health care cost reductions seen from reductions in smoking, but also in the short term, as more children are born healthy and not hampered by having been affected in the womb to smoke, and then in their early childhood to secondhand smoke. Again, want to thank this committee for taking the time to continue to pursue this very important solution. Oregon ought to be working overtime to create the healthiest generation of kids ever, and we applaud your tireless work to do just that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3558? I don't see anyone, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3558. Paul, have I dealt with the agenda? I have. The committee is adjourned.